Well, honeybees are pretty important to you and to me, actually. Honeybees do a lot, and their decline really remains a threat to agriculture that depend on bee pollination, fruits and vegetables, forage. In fact, the highest value seed crop in the U.S. requiring insect pollination is alfalfa. And if you think about alfalfa in Wisconsin, I mean, alfalfa is a crucial component of our dairy industry. We're talking today with Eric Mader of Madison, National Pollinator Outreach Coordinator at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. It's an international nonprofit organization based in Portland, Oregon. But Eric, I guess, gets around a lot. And we'll talk with him about that and talk about these issues relating to bees and pollination and certainly answer your questions as we move along. If you have a question, I hope you do, give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Eric Mader, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
How did you get involved? What does a national pollinator outreach coordinator do?
Boy, you know, if there was a 30-second answer to that, it would save me a lot of time every day. basically, the Xerces Society is sort of the leading invertebrate conservation group in the U.S. We're oftentimes thought of as sort of the Audubon Society of Insects. Mm-hmm. We have a couple major program areas, including some butterfly conservation work we do, some work for aquatic invertebrates, some endangered species advocacy work. But really the largest program area that we have right now is our pollinator conservation program. So in my role, I work with policymakers and media providers to try and shape public policy and develop a greater public dialogue about pollinators. I also provide technical support to other conservation organizations, including private nonprofit conservation organizations, as well as government conservation organizations like the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. And lastly, I think the other major area that I focus on is providing technical support to agricultural industries and agricultural professionals who depend upon bee pollination for the production of their crops.
Well, you know, bees are such interesting animals anyway, and of course we love the honey, but as you think about their impact, honeybees, for example, this is billions of dollars, is it not?
That's correct. We know, based upon the best economic models that we have, that the annual value of bee pollination to American agriculture is about $20 billion. And that $20 billion amount is divided between the contribution that honeybees make as well as the contribution that native pollinators make. One thing that often gets sort of forgotten in the discussion about pollinator issues is that the honeybee is not native to North America. We have all of these other bee species that were here present prior to the honeybee's introduction in 1622. And they also play a very important economic role in agricultural production.
So the honeybee was one of those introduced species that actually turned out to be a good thing as opposed to the opposite, which is often the case.
Yeah, that's correct.
Where do they originate from?
The honeybee, the primary European honeybee that is managed in the U.S. is from Southern Europe, mostly from the Mediterranean region, Italy, Yugoslavia. And I'm sure you've heard of the Africanized honeybee,
yes,
which was intentionally introduced to South America as part of a effort to breed more robust honeybees for tropical conditions. And those genetic lines of honeybees escaped into the wild in South America and have slowly made their way north to the southwestern U.S. So now we're seeing sort of a mixing of European and Africanized honeybees in the U.S. occurring.
And that's not necessarily a good thing.
It's not necessarily a good thing for people who want to keep gentle, docile honeybees. That's correct.
Well, so your society, in terms of the work that it does, what kind of a handle do they have on the decline of honeybee populations?
We have actually very good information about the decline of honeybees. We know, for example, that there are basically no feral honeybees left in most of the United States, with the exception of those Africanized honeybees in the desert Southwest. We know also that there has been about a 50% decline in the number of managed honeybees, honeybees kept in hives by beekeepers since 1945. And in roughly that same time period, we've seen almost a doubling of crop acreage that requires bee pollination. So we're facing the situation now where we have half the number of honeybees trying to do twice the amount of work. And there are a whole host of factors associated with this honeybee decline. I'm sure that you, and I'm sure that many of our listeners, have heard about this colony collapse disorder.
Yeah.
And we also know that parasites and diseases play a role in these honeybee declines. We're also thinking that poor nutrition may be a contributing factor in honeybee declines. Since honeybees are increasingly being forced to pollinate larger and larger monocultures, they don't necessarily get the diverse pollen and nectar sources to meet their nutritional demands. Because honeybees are bred in captivity by a queen-producing industry based in the southern U.S., we think that genetic inbreeding may have a factor in honeybee declines, reducing their overall fitness. And then sort of the last big picture issue associated with honeybee decline that does not get very much discussion is the beekeeping demographics in this country. You know, I keep honeybees myself in addition to a number of native bees, and when I go pick up my beekeeping supplies out in Watertown every spring, the next youngest beekeeper that is usually out there is about 75 years old.
And you're a young guy, but...
Well, I don't know how young, but younger than 75 anyway.
Yeah, but 40 or 50 years.
We're not seeing young people getting into the business, and it's a difficult business to be in. The economic rewards just aren't there anymore. We have Chinese honey that comes into the country at prices significantly lower than what we can produce it for here in this country. And it's hard work, it's heavy work, and there's that whole stinging thing.
to keep track of. Well, I tell you, Carmen in Cloquet, Minnesota, wonders if it's true that there's a negative relationship between bees and cell phones.
You know, this has been tossed around a little bit among the bee conservation community, and the scientists who have looked at it have not seen any connection at all. You'll also hear references to BT corn or genetically engineered crops playing a role, and similarly, we're not seeing any association between those factors and honeybee declines.
Our guest today, Eric Mader, of Madison National Pollinator Outreach Coordinator at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Our guest today, as we talk with him about bees and pollinator issues. Feel free to join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. So give us a call. We'll get some callers coming online here. What are you looking at in terms of how are you connected with the let's talk legislative. You mentioned that a little earlier before we take another call. The 2008 Farm Bill, for example, are you?
Sure. The 2008 Farm Bill, for the first time in U.S. history, prioritizes pollinator research and pollinator conservation. And this has tremendous potential to reverse some of the trends we're seeing associated with pollinator declines. Unfortunately, the research provisions in the Farm Bill are not mandatory, meaning that they are going to have to go through the appropriations process before funding can actually be distributed to universities and to USDA bee research facilities who can do some of that work. Another thing the Farm Bill does is it extends crop insurance to beekeepers and honey producers, which will do things for that industry to help them stabilize themselves through, sort of dramatic and rapid losses in their bee populations. But the last thing the Farm Bill does, and the most important thing, is it prioritizes pollinator habitat conservation for every USDA land manager and conservationist. So the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service administers a number of financial incentive programs for landowners. I'm sure that you're probably familiar with the Conservation Reserve Program.
Sure.
Well, there are a host of other similar land conservation programs like that, including the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, the Wildlife Habitat Incentives Program. And these are mechanisms for the USDA to provide landowners with some funding assistance to plant flowering buffer strips or diverse wildflower plantings that can support pollinators. Here in Wisconsin, we've seen a very strong interest among fruit growers in the state in these programs, and the state USDA NRCS office has recently put together some new conservation standards specifically targeting pollinators here in Wisconsin. And all of these efforts are sort of an outgrowth of the 2008 Farm Bill. And we were at Xerces very involved in advocating for the inclusion of these provisions.
And we'll talk some more about that and take your questions and comments as we visit with Eric Mader here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at bee and pollinator issues today with Eric Mader of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Really glad to have him with us today as we talk about these issues that affect the bees in this country and as a matter of fact, all of us because of the wonderful job that bees do pollinating our fruit and vegetable crops. And our other high-value crops as well, like alfalfa. So we're pleased to have him with us. You may have a question, and I hope you do. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison, or email us, I should say, at talk@wpr.org. And, Eric, we have Jenny online from Tomahawk who has a question or comment. So let's go there first. Jenny, hi.
Hi, Larry and Eric. It's an interesting program you have today.
Thank you
for taking the call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, when I was a kid in West Virginia, my dad used to raise bees. He had, as I recall, three hives. And every once in a while, he would decide he wanted to get new bees. And I don't know if that was to keep them from crossbreeding or not. I mean, I was a little kid. I mean, what did I know? But anyway, he could go out in the woods, spot a bee. He went to a place where there was water, spot a bee. He had his compass with him. He'd watch what direction the bee went in, set his compass so that he could follow that, and then he could walk until he found the beehive, where it would be like a big hive. This could be tame bees, I suppose, that were
somehow got away. Yeah, well, let's ask. Thanks for that, Jenny. And you raise an interesting topic, Eric.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. You know, it's interesting. I listen to people of my parents' generation or of my grandparents' generation, and they always talk about when they were growing up how everybody sort of knew where a bee tree was, mm-hmm. where there would be a hollow tree somewhere with some honeybees living in it. And these were feral honeybee colonies. These were honeybees that probably originally escaped through swarming from a managed honeybee hive and just took up residence somewhere in an appropriate cavity somewhere in the woods. And that used to be very common. But with the accidental introduction of a number of bee diseases and bee parasites from different parts of the world that were brought here primarily through the bee breeding industry, we don't see those feral populations anymore. They've basically been decimated. But you're absolutely right. There was a time in this country where people could just go out and find a hollow log or something that has honeybees living in it. And it's been sort of interesting for me traveling to different parts of the world where you can still see this. I've been to temple gardens in Japan and seen, you know, a small crack in a tree in the garden, and I'll notice some buzzing activity around it and go over and sure enough and look, and there's some little Asian honeybees coming and going from that tree. And it's sort of a sad state of affairs that we don't have that in this country anymore.
It really is. Thanks, Jenny, for reminding us about that and for bringing it up. Appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to get on here, so I'm going to go to Sally in Wayland, Minnesota. Sally, it's your turn. Hi.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Eric. Thank you very much for this opportunity to learn from your expertise. And, man, I would love to talk to Jenny about tracking bees. That would be so cool. I could put on my bee suit. I have a bee suit that my dad gave me. I'm a beekeeper here in southeastern Minnesota. I learned how to beekeep at a nonprofit called Eagle Bluff Environmental Learning Center. It's just outside of Lanesboro. And I really want to keep my own bees. I think it's a good thing, and I know how to do it. The problem is that the hives are very expensive. I priced one out. I mean, just to get all the startup stuff, smokers and all the supplies, the hives, it would be like $300 just for one hive, and that's actually not a large hive. That's like the starter kit. Is there any way that I can get help to buy some hives so that I can keep bees and, you know, help the planet?
Sure. You know, unfortunately, you are very much correct. Honeybee keeping equipment is very expensive. There are a few alternatives out there that might be useful to you. The large beekeeping suppliers, like in Minnesota, you have Man Lake Beekeeping, and there's a few others, sort of catalog beekeeping services out there. Most of them sell different grades of hives. So you can get sort of the high-end version of the honeybee hive that is made of the best quality lumber. And then these beekeeping supply companies usually sell what they call commercial-grade equipment, which are the pine boards that have knot holes in them or have slight cracks and so on. So that's one thing to look into. Another alternative, which is much more of a sort of do-it-yourselfer approach, is to look at keeping bees in what's called top bar hives. And these are primarily an African honeybee hive type that you unfortunately cannot buy pre-made, but with some fairly simple hand tools and a trip to Menards or Home Depot, you can pick up the supplies and put this together yourself. If you do a Google search on top bar hives, I'm sure that you will find plenty of blueprints out there. In other states, we've seen actual grant programs to help beginning beekeepers buy equipment. North Carolina has done something like this. New Jersey has done something like this. And where we've seen these programs, we've seen a very positive and direct impact in the number of beginning beekeepers. So hopefully some of the relevant funding organizations will consider this for Minnesota. I want to give one last plug for Minnesota in particular and somebody else you might want to check with, and that is Dr. Marla Spivak at the University of Minnesota's Bee Lab in their Department of Entomology is probably our greatest regional resource for beekeeping information. So it's worth giving her lab a call and seeing what resources she might be able to point you to as well. And your local cooperative extension person could put you in touch with her.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Steve in Sparta, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was looking for a local chapter or organization to help a beginning beekeeper get started.
Okay. Again, I think the person I would direct you to would be I would direct you to Dr. Marla Spivak at the University of Minnesota Bee Lab. They have a short course every winter, and the sign-up for that is probably taking place here fairly soon. So I would check with that department. That short course is sort of a nationally known endeavor, and they do great work. They take you through sort of a two-day course in the basics of beginning beekeeping. They talk about basic bee biology, the tools that you're going to need to get started. And there are people that come from really all over the eastern U.S. to attend this course, so I would check that out.
So that's the University of Minnesota Department of Entomology.
That's correct.
And well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. I just Googled it in, and there she popped right up. So you can go online and find that information, Steve. Just if Marla Spivak Bees is what I put in, and University of Minnesota popped right up.
Yep.
All right, let's go to Lynn in Hartford next. Lynn, hello to you.
Hi, and thank you for the program.
Sure.
One comment before my question. I would just encourage people to visit the Honey Museum here, and it's just in the Ashapan area of Wisconsin. It's got a nice little, it'd be a nice weekend trip for families and kids. I'm not sure what their seasonal hours are, but anyways, my question is I'm wondering about the effects of mostly residential or perhaps commercial pesticide use on the bee population, and what people could be, forewarned as well as encouraged in terms of their utilization of that, and what effect that might be having.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. Pesticides are a huge issue in terms of bee conservation. We've seen cases where non-target pesticide applications have really decimated local native bee numbers. There was a very well-known case in the 1970s in Nova Scotia and northern Maine where spray applications for the spruce budworm decimated native bee numbers to the point that blueberry growers in the area just did not have sufficient native bees for their crop pollination. Agricultural chemicals are fairly well regulated, and they have label information on there that typically tells you what their toxicity is to bees. And when I say that, I mean that these labels specifically refer to honeybees. Unfortunately, some of our native bees are significantly smaller than honeybees and can be affected by much lower doses of pesticides. So I would definitely encourage both agricultural producers and residential gardeners to exercise a lot of caution with pesticides. The Xerces Society has a number of publications that sort of address how to reduce pesticide toxicity to bees. And those are all available on our website, which is www.xerces.org. So I would encourage you to take a look there for some more information.
So Xerces is xerces.org. That's the place to go. All right. Thank you, Lynn, for calling. Appreciate it. And you mentioned native bees. Before we go back to the phones, native bees in Wisconsin are pretty important, but their numbers can be endangered.
Yes, that's correct. You know, prior to the introduction of the honeybee here in North America, we had about 4,000 different species of native bees. And these ranged from very, very small green sweat bees that nest underground all the way up to large carpenter bees that would excavate nest holes in stems of rotted trees or in hollow logs. And here in Wisconsin, we have a tremendous amount of native bee diversity as well. The leading bee taxonomists in the country have identified 351 distinct species here in the state of Wisconsin. We know from records of bee collections in adjacent states that there are probably 200 other bees, bee species that have not yet been found in Wisconsin, but which are probably here. And some of these are very important agricultural pollinators, especially our bumblebees. We know, for example, that on crops like blueberry and cranberry, that under all parameters, bumblebees are at a minimum 8 times more efficient on a bee per bee basis than honeybees for moving pollen between these flowers. Unfortunately, we are seeing fairly dramatic declines in some of our bumblebee numbers here in the eastern U.S., and including here in Wisconsin. We have about 15 species of bumblebees here in Wisconsin, and we have not seen 3 of those species in any significant numbers in about 10 years.
Mm.
So that represents a potential loss of 1/5 of our bumblebee diversity here in the state.
That's a huge loss. Well, Robert in Bear Creek has a question or comment for you. Robert, hello.
Hi, Robert Lorge here at Capitol Hill Farms or Honeybees. We raise honeybees also. And the thing that got me into it was noticing there weren't any bees around. And we have a orchard there up at our farm in Bear Creek, so we got into it, and we're kind of into it commercially now nationwide. But the thing we've noticed is that with corn in particular, a lot of people probably don't know this, but the current way they introduce pesticides into corn is with systemic neonicotinoids, where they soak the seeds in it, and as the corn grows, the pesticide goes into every leaf and cell of the corn plant, so that when weevils and things like that eat the corn, they get sick and they fly away disorientated, kind of like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease in people, to never attack the corn plant again. And unfortunately, the bees seem to be, they don't like corn because it's wind pollinated and it's heavy pollen, but 10% of the pollen in a hive near cornfields, is corn pollen anyway. They kind of learn they don't like it, but they still incorporate it into the hive. And there's been a lot of talk that this might be what CCD, colony collapse disorder, is, because the bees leave the hive. They don't come back in, so there's no bees really to autopsy, but you're talking 40 to 60,000 bees per colony hive just up and disappearing.
Yeah, comment on this, Eric?
Yeah, you know, thank you for bringing this up. This issue with the systemic synthetic nicotine compounds has been around for a while now, and the Europeans have looked at this very closely, and it has led to the banning of these seed treatments in several European countries. And their expectation was that once these products were removed from the marketplace, that they would see a rebound in their bee numbers. Unfortunately, that has not occurred. So this is one of those issues where the jury is still out on the documentable impact that these chemicals are actually having. I think that you bring up another interesting point, which is that bees are collecting corn pollen. And I see this myself with my own honeybees that I keep and with other honeybees out there. Corn pollen is very low in protein. It has the nutritional benefits to bees that corn cobs have for people. Ah. It's basically empty fiber. It's filler. And bees, unfortunately, are so starved for pollen resources because we have these huge monocultures of corn that they are oftentimes left with little alternative but to forage on corn pollen to feed their young. So I think that the synthetic nicotine issue, the neonicotinoids, I think that we need some additional research on that. But I think that we also need good quality habitat. We need good quality food sources for our bees.
Yeah, absolutely. I thank you very much for calling, Robert. Appreciate it. And I want to give Steve from Freedom a chance. Steve, hello to you.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment and then ask a quick question. I was up near Marinette about a month or so ago, actually about 2 months ago, and at the state park, the Copper Culture State Park, there was a honey tree there, and it was quite active. I just thought I'd pass that along. And also, I wonder if your guest could tell the college where you could get started in beekeeping and where the bee supply is in Waterton.
Sure. The University of Minnesota's Department of Entomology has a bee lab. Unfortunately, here in Wisconsin, we no longer have a bee lab at our university. We used to have a USDA bee lab facility here until it was closed down in the 1980s. So that department is at the Twin Cities campus, and if you do a Google search on Department of Entomology, University of Minnesota, honeybee, you will find all of the relevant information associated with that. The bee keeping supply store in Watertown, I believe, is called LAPS, L-A-P-P-S, and you can probably find them through a Google search as well.
All right. Thank you very much. And we heard several emails. Blair emailed and wondered about if you knew anybody in the Lake Geneva area that will remove honeybees. He has a pest control company, and they have requests to kill nests, and their preference is removal as opposed to elimination. And any beekeepers we have talked to won't remove them from a cavity. So he's wondering about training or beekeepers in that area.
Sure. Well, I appreciate his no-kill policy with honeybees. The person to talk to would probably be the state apiary inspector at the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection here in Madison. If you give a call down there and ask for the apiary department, they can probably give you some referrals to folks up in your area.
And appreciate that email as well. What do you recommend? Somebody else wondered. What do you recommend for winter care here in the last minute or so? I do have some honey froze to add to the hives if they run low, and I did clean the snow away from the entry. Anything else?
Good insulation. I keep my honeybees in the new sort of Scandinavian-style styrofoam hives, and I know a lot of you beekeepers out there who are listening to this are probably cringing upon hearing that, but they overwinter very well, so anything you can do to insulate those hives would be beneficial.
So get good insulation. She's done the other things, honey frozen and yep. keeping the hole open and all that, but otherwise Get it insulated.
Keep them warm.
Okay. And your email address, or I'm sorry, your web address again, for those who want to find out more.
It's www.xercces.org.
Xercces.org. And offered Mark from has an offer. He says, Bees Rock. That was an email from Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
And he's right. Eric, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit.
Thank you, Larry.
Eric Mader of Madison, National Pollinator Outreach Coordinator at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Again, www.xercces.org. And that will get you to him and to the rest of his organization. Well, coming up tomorrow, we'll talk home renovation and repair issues. Ken Adams and John Freiberger make a return visit. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.